Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
The JCC of the East Bay, located just over there on Walnut Street, one of our locations, is a 40-year-old institution that proudly offers arts and cultural events, youth programs, and much more in Oakland and Berkeley. And for today's program, we're especially grateful for the support of Eve Gordon Ramek in honor of Mayor Goldberg and Henry Ramek. Without further ado, thank you to Dr. Edith Eger for being here with us today.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Julie. Thank you, JCC of the East Bay and the Eve Gordon Ramek support in memory of Mayor Goldberg and Henry Ramek. My name is Elizabeth Rosner. I'm a Berkeley resident and an author, and it's such an honor to be here today with Dr. Eger. I'm asked to remind you to please silence your cell phones if you haven't already done so. Thank you. And after the talk, we will be more than happy to greet you out in the lobby where Edie will be signing copies of her book. Can everybody hear me all right? Okay. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about what Professor Philip Zimbardo has said about Dr. Eger, and I know a lot of you are here because you already know what an extraordinary human being you have before you today, and what a privilege it is for us to get to hear your story. But I'm going to read from the introduction briefly. Dr. Eger's life has been full of darkness. She was imprisoned at Auschwitz when she was just a teenager. Despite torture, starvation, and the constant threat of annihilation, she preserved her mental and spiritual freedom. She was not broken by the horrors she experienced. She was emboldened and strengthened by them. In fact, her wisdom comes from deep within the most devastating episodes of her life. She is able to help others heal because she has journeyed from trauma to triumph herself.
Wow.
Sounds pretty good even to you, right? So the book itself, which I want to refer to frequently because after all, we're here at a book festival, we're here to celebrate the written word, and we're so, so fortunate that you were able to share your story with us in this way. The book is called The Choice, Embrace the Possible. And we're going to find out more about why you gave it that title, assuming you got to choose your title, that is. And I'll tell you a little bit about the structure of the book. The first significant quarter of the book describes Edie's experience before and during her imprisonment in Auschwitz. And then the book moves into her life afterward, her marriage, her raising of children, her going back to school. And then this discovery that there was a trauma you hadn't yet processed yourself, and how working with other people who had endured traumatic experiences brought you into facing your own darkest stories. So there's a moment in the beginning where you referenced your ballet master.
Yes.
If you can't tell, she's a dancer. I want to beg her to stand up and perform, but
we're going to dance after this.
We'll meet you dancing out in the lobby. Your ballet master said, Edie, your ecstasy comes from inside. Can you talk about that?
Yes, you're so wonderful, the way you're going to really carry us so beautifully. I like movement, and I like to call myself a guide, not a therapist, and not to pathologize, because I think in some ways we're all victims of victims. So while you blame, you're still a child, you know, when someone says, he did this to me, and that. So I am telling you about the ballet master, because my parents had two beautiful girls, Magda, who is still alive, She lives in Baltimore. She was the pretty one. She calls me now and she tells me I'm gorgeous.
And she's 96.
She's 96, but I know that she's 97. Go figure. Magda was with me in Auschwitz, and Clara was a child prodigy in violin, and she was the only Jewish girl accepted at the Music Academy in Budapest. When she was already in a camp, her professor, Waldbar, the name, smuggled her out and hid her until the end of the war. And the way I found out that she was alive, when we came from Vienna to Prague, I saw advertisements with a violin that she's giving a concert. And she became a violinist at the Sydney Opera House. So my parents decided, well, we must have a son. And guess what happened? They got me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what the word ecstasy meant. I became cross-eyed when I was 3 years old. And my two sisters blindfolded me when they took me for a walk because they didn't want anyone to see what an ugly sister they have. I can still sing the Hungarian song to you that I'm so ugly and puny and I'm never going to find a husband. So my mother took me to the ballet school. So this guy picks me up and tells me about, you know, the ecstasy has to come from inside out. But I didn't know what ecstasy meant. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what he was talking about until I was in Auschwitz when nothing came from without. And we had to discover, and I like to talk about that power mm-hmm. that no one, no Nazi could ever, ever take away from me.
So it's just so interesting to me that this is one of the many examples you give in the book of the way that what may have been seen as a curse turned out to be a blessing for you. And this idea that you were told by your mother, it's too bad you're not beautiful, at least you're smart.
Yes. She did say that, I'm so glad you have brains because you have no looks. Yes, 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 but you know, I'm not angry at my mom. I became a very erudite teenager, actually. I graduated with honors in the university. In Texas.
Your education is quite a story in itself because of all the waves of time
Everything.
Away from school. But I also wanted to come back to this notion that your intelligence also guided you through your experience in the camp, that your awareness that it would enable you to survive if you thought about it. And that reminds me of things my father has said about his time in concentration camp also, that thinking was important. Keeping your wits about you.
I came to America penniless in 1949. I didn't speak a word of English. Everything was okay. And my late husband ended up in a TB hospital. I became the breadwinner. So you see, I didn't know how to ever say anything about Auschwitz. I just wanted to be a Yankee Doodle Dandy. I wanted to be like you. So I went completely underground, mm-hmm. and I had a secret. Mm-hmm. And not until I began to work with Vietnam vets, and I studied the whole post-traumatic stress reaction. It's not a disorder. We pathologize too much. And I had two paraplegics, and one of them was telling me in a fetal position, why me, and cursing God, country, you name it. And conversely, the other one says to me, you know, Doc, I'm sitting in a wheelchair and I'm so grateful that God gave me a second chance. I can see the children's eyes much closer. I see the flowers. And I'm sitting there and I have a white coat that says Dr. Eager, Department of Psychiatry. And I feel like a biggest imposter. Because I had a 16-year-old girl in me. I could not take them further than I have gone myself. And I decided to go back to Auschwitz. And that's the work I do today. Mm-hmm. That I give you my hand, and we're going to revisit the places where you've been. And you tell it to me as if it would happen now, because there is no grieving without feeling. You can't heal what you don't feel. So I remember when I was watching Schindler's List, people were walking out. And I remember I felt like I was on a Grand Canyon. And it was very scary looking down there, but I was up here looking at it. And I was in a movie with two of my grandchildren, and I felt so wonderful. So there you are. I knew that I couldn't take them further than I have gone myself. And I decided to go back, and I called my sister Magda. I said, you know, Magda, we lost our family, and we never went to a funeral. I want to go back to Auschwitz. It's the biggest cemetery. And she told me, I'm an idiot. She says, not only you're an idiot, but you're a masochist. So, you know, you have the same experience, but two entirely different responses. Mm-hmm.
That's really important, what you're pointing out. And I think in addition to the reason I began with that story about your ballet master and this idea of what you carry inside of you is that it's also been a great mystery to me how differently people endured what they did during the war and also in every experience of violence, mm-hmm. challenge. And so there is something you brought to that experience, and Magda brought what she brought to the experience. You describe her flirting in the camp and using her beauty because that's what she had. And in the same way that even now your choices are different. Yes. So your choice to return to Auschwitz was part of your healing, and it wasn't part of hers.
You know, I stood in line in December to get my tattoo. And I didn't get it. I don't have a tattoo. And I was told that I'm going to the gas chamber because they don't want to waste the ink on me. And then I noticed that Magda was in a different pile than I was. I think survivors have to be very quick decision makers. It's not why me, it's what now. So I did some cartwheels. And
she means literal cartwheels.
Really?
She did cartwheels.
Yeah. And anyway, we were out of Auschwitz and we were bombed. We carried ammunition. We became slave laborers. And we were bombed and they opened the door and I was the first one to jump, you know. And I go to the... I'm trying to picture it. I'm in the middle of the bombing, you know. I run, and Magda was not with me. So I go back in the middle of the bombing, and Magda jumped, and she fell. And I am ashamed to tell you. There were some political prisoners, I guess, eating, and I chewed her out. That now she looks like this. Because she could ask for some food. It did not occur to me that I could ask for food too, because I was the ugly one, and she was. I'm ashamed to tell you that I am chewing out my sister because I go by the name that I was given, and so, you know, we can rewrite all that, that we can be our good parents, and mm-hmm. I do that. Mm-hmm. I ask people to a good parent to you. Mm-hmm. Because temptation is here. You know why? So you can practice the freedom of choice. I can't is not in my vocabulary.
I can't is not in her vocabulary.
No. I can, you know why? Because I think I can. Mm-hmm. The choo-choo train. I think I can.
I love that so many phrases that come out of you really are like slogans, and they're not cliches when I hear them with your beautiful Hungarian accent. They feel earned to me. And this idea that you talk about in the book when your family arrived at Auschwitz and your father saw the Arbeit macht frei sign, and he thought that meant everything was going to be okay because it was just a place where they had to work until the war was over. Work will set you free. And it was your experience later in life when you recognized that the work you had to do to set yourself free was an entirely different kind of work, and that the revisiting of that phrase became a mantra of your own about being set free by your own inner process, your inner challenge. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, they could throw me in a gas chamber any day, and they beat me and tortured and all that was going on, but they could never, ever murder my spirit. So I like to talk about the there and then and bring it into the here and now. Because the more we depend on other people to make us happy, like I beg parents, don't spoil your children, because those were the first one to die. They would just sit there and wait, you know, who's gonna come. And they died. They gave up very quickly. Or they attacked the guards, and of course they were shot right away. So, you know, Hans Selye talks about the stress studies, that if anything stressful comes to you, you have two automatic responses. You either fight or flee. I couldn't fight because if I would have touched the guards, they would have immediately shot me. I couldn't flee because if I would have touched the barbed wires, I would have been electrocuted. So I somehow decided at the age of 16, that they were the prisoners. I don't know how it came about, because I was told every day that the only way I will get out of here is as a corpse. And I said to myself, if I survive today, then tomorrow I will meet my boyfriend. Because he told me that I have beautiful eyes and I have beautiful hands. So I would go to everyone, tell me about my hands, tell me about my eyes. Mm. You know, it didn't occur to me that I'm going to listen to that guy who was, you know, going in this uniform, prancing around. And somehow I was able to, with God's guidance, I think God helped me to turn hatred into pity. So people ask, where was God in Auschwitz? God was with me. Mm-hmm. God was with me in love to me even today. I may not like what you do, but I'm going to give you unconditional regard just because you're human. I'm always having difficulties with tremendous survivors' guilt and shame. I don't know why, but when I graduated with honors and they told me where to, I'm not summa cum laude, but I'm cum laude, because I thought the more I study, the more I will deserve that I survived. So I didn't show up for my graduation because I didn't think I had the right. But then, you see, I had to go back to Auschwitz to reclaim my innocence, to assign the shame and guilt to the perpetrator, and begin to forgive myself that I survived. So I'm still not done. Mm-hmm. I'm still climbing that mountain, mm-hmm. and I'm very curious, and I want to get to know you. And the doctor told me not to come here today because I had pneumonia, and I am recovering. And I said to the doctor, I'm going, and I'm showing up. And yes, I'm not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. And thank you. Because I think young, people ask me, you know, what keeps you so young? I see that I live in the present. Mm. I can only touch you now. So I want to hug you. I want to touch you. And I want to be so grateful that we are here truly celebrating every moment of life. Because to me, every moment is precious. I never take anything for granted. I don't like to leave food on my plate. My daughter tells me, it's okay, Mom. It's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Mm-hmm. It still pains me to throw away even mm-hmm. a piece of bread. Mm-hmm. So there is so much to say, and we have
there
so little
There is so
time.
Much to say. I could just anyway, let you go on. You, I
like people to read your book. She already wrote 5 books, and the latest one is called Survivor's Cafe. It's a wonderful, and she's a child of survivor. And I like to maybe to tell you that children of immigrants parentize their children. They're the ones, my little girl was 2 years old, she went to a school, she brought home a book called Chicken Little. And the sky is falling, and then came Ducky Lucky, Goosey Lucy, Turkey Lucky. So I'm looking at my 2-year-old teaching me how to speak English, because I didn't know Ducky from Lucky and Lucy. She became one of the most brilliant child psychologists. Mm. I want to show up with Marianne. And the doctor told me when I became pregnant that he's not allowing me to have a child because I'm too weak. Get a second opinion, because I told the doctor I want to give life. And my late husband in Czechoslovakia in 1946 apologized to the doctor that his wife doesn't know how to talk to a doctor respectfully. Say, speak up, speak up, speak up. Marianne is a brilliant child psychologist, and she's married to Robert Engel, who got the Nobel Prize in economics. Mm. So I'm showing off. I have 3 children. I have 2 daughters. And after 2 daughters, I had a son. And my late husband was very, very, very anxious to keep the Eger name, the rabbi, Rabbi Akiva Eger. But the son didn't develop like the girls. And I told the doctors, you know, that there is something, you know, he's not sitting up. So I know that the pediatrician told me, you know, I know you have a book club, I know you're an intellectual, you may need to prepare your son is going to go to a school for retarded children. This is 1960, and I see, where do I get a second opinion? At Johns Hopkins. I arrive at Johns Hopkins, a neurologist, Dr. Clark, takes my son, a bit later says, you know, the son is going to be what you make of him. He's not retarded. He looks that way, he's drooling, so on. And I'm sitting there and said, what are you doing now? I said, I'm a student. He said, well, he's going to need speech therapy, occupational, so forth, so on. How much do I owe you? $10, 1960. I come home, I drop out of school. I just want to tell you about that power of the spirit that I discovered in Auschwitz. No, never give up hope. My son John graduated as a top 10 student from the University of Texas. Mm. So that's what I really would like to, you know, I'm at the evening of my life. Mm. I'm 90 years old and wondered, you know, how do I want to be remembered? Mm-hmm. And I want to be remembered as someone who did everything in her power to see to it that will never ever happen to again. I owe it to my parents that I didn't die in vain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, message received. Message received. So this way that you exemplify your own perseverance, your own will to live, your own strength from within, and that you transmit that to your chutzpah. You transmitted it to your children, to your grandchildren. You have great-grandchildren now. You're transmitting it through
this book. I have three of those, and the little one calls me Gigi Baby. Ha! What can be more beautiful? I have four generations, that's the best revenge to Hitler.
Yeah, true. There are so many, you can see, I flagged all these pages in the book. There are so many things you've already touched on about, there's a line you say that sometimes you have to, in order to move forward, you have to circle back. And that's the part about your physical, literal return to Auschwitz, but also your willingness to look at the shadows that you were still carrying, the secrets, really.
And the question I ask, are you revolving or are you evolving? Mm. And so many people call me a good midwife, and I like that. That's okay. And maybe after today, you're going to give birth to the you that was meant to be. To be free at last, yes.
So she's doing group therapy with all of us right now. But it's true. I think you have this wonderful capacity to share your wisdom, and it's deep in you, this experience, this set of experiences that you're able to offer up through your words and just through your presence.
Nothing can be more, I'm so grateful that not only I survived, but I can guide other people to find their own freedom. And I'm getting wonderful feedback. And
she's still working.
Believe me, at 90, you can do it. You can do it. So I hope that, see, what comes out of your body doesn't make you ill. What stays in there does. So that's
One of the things that you write about in the book with such transparency, as you're being transparent here today by allowing us to also hear the vulnerability and the shame, the shameful pieces that still are with you. This idea that, you know, your own pacing, your own timing had to be what it was. That when your daughter came home from school asking questions, and when Bela, your husband, said, you know, your mother was there. Your mother was in Auschwitz. And you were not happy about that, right?
My daughter wore a beautiful dress. And my husband says, go, honey, have a good time, because when mother was in your age, she was in Auschwitz, and I thought I was going to kill him. You know, I really thought I was going to. By the way, I like to say that we don't grieve over what happened, but what didn't happen. May I kind of tell you?
Please.
My granddaughter was born, Lindsay, and the pediatrician said that she may become a ballerina. And I said to myself, great, now I can die. You know, I have now three generations. But she did become a little ballerina. And she asked me to buy her a dress so she can go to her dance. And so I came home, and out of the blue, I'm crying. I don't understand. Why am I crying? I just bought Lindsay a beautiful dress. And then I realized that I'm not crying because Lindsay went to a dance. I cried because I never went to a dance. And that's why, you see, many times we use these defense mechanisms. Oh, it wasn't such a big thing. It is a big thing. And I hope that I can be today giving you an opportunity that perhaps you want to take stock of your life, because you know what? Our ancestors, I usually tell women, you're not a strong woman, you are a woman of strength. The power comes within us. We're not only smart, we're wise. We figure out man, and we know all about the ego too. And so I think it's very important for you to acknowledge that our ancestors didn't have it as good as we did, and they made it. And we carry that blood, mm-hmm. you see? Mm-hmm. See? Yes, I am. Yes, I can. Yes, I will. Lots of let'ses. Because when I was liberated and they put me in the hospital and I was in a cast and I could hardly breathe and I had typhoid fever and I got up in the morning and I realized that my parents are not coming back. Reality hit me and I became very suicidal. Mm-hmm. And today I work with the suicide, I work with the military. And they come home and they take their lives. So I'm doing everything in my power to prevent that. And I know that God said to me that it's better to be for something and to be for life and not to be a coward. And I'm grateful that today I am in a healing arts profession. Mm-hmm. Isn't that
It's
wonderful?
Remarkable what you do in the book when you relate some anecdotes about people that you've worked with and are continuing to work with now, including there's one really quite extraordinary and I think especially relevant to this moment encounter you have with a 14-year-old kid who who is essentially a neo-Nazi. And he's sitting in your office.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah, he's exclaiming his platform, his white supremacist, hate-filled platform, and you very generously describe the moments in which your own rage and violent feelings toward him arise, and then you force yourself to say, where is the bigot in me? Where is the bigot in me?
That's right.
And you wait, and you very, very patiently, what you talked about before, that fight or flee response, you chose to wait in that space to not really manage your feelings, but allow your feelings to pass through you until you decide to say to him, tell me more.
Yeah, that's the difference between reacting or responding. So in the English language, when you're angry, this is what I say to the children, because I do a lot of lecturing on bullying. I know bullies are cowards and so on.
Did you hear that? Bullies are cowards, she just said under her breath.
So when you hear you say to yourself, I'm going to be dumped on. We still live in America, there is free speech. The more they talk, the more relaxed I become. You have the choice to react or to respond. And just take a deep breath and say to yourself, I'm practicing my low frustration tolerance level. So I'm not a shrink, I'm a stretch. So you can truly also stretch your comfort zone. And I think Auschwitz was an opportunity to discover the kind of skills like how to move beyond the me. And I know that Magda was more hungry than I was, and I ate the soup, but I shared the bread, that we still had choices. And when I danced for Dr. Mengele, he gave me a piece of bread and I shared it with the girls. And when I was on the death march, April 1945, when you stop, you were shot. And the girls that I shared the bread with, they formed a chair with their arms and they carried me so I wouldn't die. Isn't that amazing that if you're only the me, you didn't make it? And all we had was each other then.
So they remembered the gift of the shared bread, and they saw that it was your turn to need help.
Yeah, Magda was heavier. I was skinny, but I was full of muscles. So I think this is why I am always finding somehow a gift in everything. Mm-hmm.
There's a passage rather early in the book also where you went and you ran to a garden and dug up a little carrot that you found bring to your sister, and that almost got you killed.
You're such a good interviewer. you're so good. I was interviewed by Larry King. He's quite a guy. And and he said to me that he interviewed other survivors, and they never found a kind person. Mm-hmm. So I tell him that I experienced in April 1945, when my sister told me that she's so hungry, and if I don't get anything, she's going to die. And I didn't care about we were told we're going to be shot if we dare to leave the premises, so I go outside, and I don't care what they told me, but I saw some carrots in the next garden. I didn't have any respect for anybody's property, and I jumped, I stole the carrots, I came up, I met the guard with a gun. And I heard the clicking, and there was an eye contact. And it was like a father. Have you ever had a German father?
Can I have one now.
he can kill you with your eyes. anyway, he turned the gun around and pushed me inside. I have a pretty bad scoliosis. But he came back the following day and wanted to know who dared to break the rules. And I'm crawling to him. And he said, "You must have been very hungry for what you did, and gave me a little loaf of bread. I wish I could meet that man today."
I'm going to just read you that passage. "You must have been very hungry to do what you did," he says. "I wish I could meet that man now. He's proof that 12 years of Hitler's Reich isn't enough hate to take the good out of people. His eyes are my father's eyes, green and full of relief."
Oh, yeah, thank you.
The book is really beautifully written, in addition to being incredibly powerful and full of wisdom, hard-earned wisdom. One of the things you say is that to heal is to cherish the wound.
Yes, it's my cherished wound. Yes, yeah, it's there. And people tell me, you overcame. No, I did not. I will never forget, I will not overcome, but I go through the valley of the shadow of death. I don't camp there. And I think it's very important to know that I don't run anymore. I don't fight that anymore. I am at peace knowing that somehow there is a Jewish word, beshed, that for me to go through that schooling called Auschwitz, and not to recover, but to discover the compassionate listening that I can listen to that neo-Nazi. And because if I would have reacted, I would have shaken that boy up, Mm-hmm. And I would say, "Who do you think you're talking to?" But I knew that my job is to create an atmosphere. We women are very good at that. That I give him permission to feel any feelings without a fear of being judged. Mm-hmm. It's called unconditional love. And I think that good parents do that. But the best parent is who is helping their children to go out to the world that is not waiting for them and do it without the parents.
Say more about that. What the children do without the parents?
Well, they may have to go through to suffering, and suffering is feelings. And I know that many parents buy presents for the children when the children don't even ask for it. Mm-hmm. So I write that constitution for a family. There is no freedom without responsibility. It's anarchy. There is the genes. I think it's now talking about 40%. I thought it was 50%. I cannot change your genes. There's the environment. But I like to talk about how I respond to the other two. Mm-hmm. I have that choice.
Well, so when you thought you were protecting your children from your history...
That's right.
And then you realized that you said earlier, that you can't heal what you haven't already
you
worked
can't
on
heal
yourself.
What you don't feel. And so it's about the grieving, the feeling, and the healing. And I'm still not done. I'm still climbing that mountain. I slip and I climb, but I never stop climbing. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious, and curiosity was a tremendous asset in Auschwitz. I always wanted to know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You say, among the other many beautiful lines in the book, time doesn't heal, it's what you do with the time.
Exactly. Exactly.
So your healing process is very active. You're not just waiting for time.
I'm very active. Yeah. I will never retire. I think that I have a lot to say, and the expression is the opposite of depression. Mm-hmm. So what comes out...
It sounds like you're a pretty unconventional therapist.
Yes,
You know, you describe some of these encounters with, you know, you've got a vet in the room with a gun, and he's homicidal. He wants to kill his wife, whom he found out his wife has been cheating on him. And you are in your office with a man with a gun.
That's right.
And you tell him that you have to go for a walk with me.
Yes.
You gave him an order.
Because he's a military. And the only way I talk to the military, because military, they either give orders or they get orders. So I always outrank them.
Note to self.
So if you're a captain, I become the general. And that's when your clinical training comes handy. You know, I have 6,000 clinical hours. Only 3 is required. I always walk the extra mile. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It didn't hurt me any because I saw this man. He was totally catatonic. Mm-hmm. And I was with a psychiatrist next door. And I knew if I'm going to take him to the psychiatrist, he's going to be in a hospital in no time, and he's going to get Haldol. And the Haldol has side effects. You get tardive dyskinesia for life. Okay? So I did everything in my power to see what I can do, and I had a beautiful dog, test of the D'Urberville, and I looked at the man and said, we're going to go for a walk. My dog needs to go to the park. And he's looking at me, how can I get out of here? What am I doing here with this woman speaking with a Hungarian accent? But he's a good soldier. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. I had to move him. And when he came back, I could see that now, maybe. And many, many hours later, my silk blouse was, you know, totally wet. And he had a gun. And he was on his way to kill his wife and her boss. And a friend said, why don't you stop by at this woman's? Because I was consulting and I did my doctoral work with the military. That's how I became the military psychologist. Mm-hmm. And that's why I work with the military.
There's another extraordinary scene in here where you're about to address the 71st, is it Airborne Division? I'm forgetting who the 71st Army.
I was liberated. Guess what? May 4th, it's coming, 1945, by the 71st Infantry, all right? A couple years ago, I get a call from a general, Dr. Eger, would you please come? You have a good name about being an expert on PTSD. It's Fort Carson, Colorado City. And I arrive, and all I see is 71. And it's the home of the 71st Infantry. So imagine when I told them that without that uniform, I wouldn't be here today. So somehow everything kind of works. Things come around. And I just couldn't believe it that here I am thanking them that they came to get me, that hopefully America doesn't have any room for fascism.
Amen. There's another piece of that story in the book where you're seeing the number 71, but you're also having flashbacks.
Always, every day.
Yeah. So you describe that experience of, you know, the seeing of the American flags, the uniforms, transport you immediately back to your near-dead state, and that your body still has that memory.
That's right. I was on the advisory committee for the VA, and as such, I would go to Washington and go through the museum, and I said to myself, I'm not going there. I've been there, done that. But after 6 years, I came on Sunday. I didn't have anything to do. I went to the Holocaust Museum. So I go up on the fourth floor, and I see, and I'm looking for the GIs with the flag who came to get me. And I see pictures, you know, Italy, France, so on. And one on the right, new arrivals in Auschwitz, May 1944, Hungary. And I don't know, don't look for me, but I thought I was there. And I knew that the following morning I'm going to be at the advisory committee for the VA. And there is a big sign, Dr. Edith Eva Eager, and I wondered how did that girl at 16 became Dr. Edith Eva Eager, the journey of your life that I'm hoping today to give you an opportunity to free yourself from the biggest concentration camp that may be in your own mind, and the key is in your pocket. Excuse me.
There's water here.
Thank you.
The question of forgiveness comes up often, and I'm struck again and again in your writing about the way that you return the issue to the internal process of forgiveness. That, as you've already described so eloquently, this idea that, that what happens outside of you isn't really where the work gets done. So you talk about this journey you just mentioned, the journey of forgiving yourself. Can you say a little bit about that?
To me, revenge gives you satisfaction, but I think it's very temporary. And people say to me, you're such a good person, you forgave the Nazis. I said, no, I don't have that kind of godly power. I just don't want the Nazi to live in me. I want to have joy. I want to have passion. And so I release them and give myself permission to be free, to have joy and to have passion. But I also let you know that I go dancing every Sunday. I go swing dancing, and the children call it supermarket music. That it's, you know, that forgiveness is really forgive, that it's not, you know, it's not up to me to forgive the Nazis. But I think there is a Nazi in every one of us. And so is goodness and kindness. And what we reach for every day, and I reach for the hope, but I'm not minimizing or trivializing, because never, unfortunately, genocide is still here as we speak.
Yes.
But never in the history of mankind such a scientific and systematic annihilation existed. So it's not comparable, because 15 highly, highly educated people got together in the evening, celebrated that they can put 30,000 Jews in the oven in one day. 1.5 million were children.
So. My father returns to that number often when he talks about his own feeling about being a survivor. And I was just talking to him on the phone this morning. I asked him, what should I ask Edie? What would you want to say to Edie? And he said that the way he's made sense of his survival, which is often hard for him to make sense of, as I know you have struggled with that sometimes too, he says, I try to do with my life what I imagine some of those 1.5 million children might have been able to do. And I think about your commitment to using your experience and what you gained from it to continue to improve the world and make the world a better place. So you're leaving a legacy. Is there a way that you summarize your legacy, your great-grandchildren, your book, the work that you do?
I too have a dream that someday we're going to empower each other with our differences. That I can be I, you can be you. And form a human family. And that's how I am seeing myself, as a gift of God, who is going to do everything in her power. And also mentioning that there was 40 days in Muzadag, there are many, 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 many ways that unfortunately we still have genocide. But I think I like to talk about what is and what I can build on and what I can do preventively. And that's why I want to show up and let them know that you too have a choice, not just to survive, but to thrive and to know. And I talk to children in school that I tell them, you are beautiful because God doesn't make junk. and that is very, very good. Mm-hmm. That we all are a gift of God. And I know that when I will be on my deathbed, I'm going to feel so satisfied that I was here with you, that I showed up for you, and I did everything in my power to see to it that one of the most beautiful gifts of God is a gift of memory, that I will do that, knowing that my parents didn't die in vain. So I am very, very grateful to show up. And I love Martin Buber, you know, and he talked about the I and thou. He was selling his book, and a young man wanted to talk to him, and he brushed this man aside, who ended up going home and committing suicide. And when he found out, he said, the book is an it. Hmm. And I could have saved a life. Hmm. So this is the way I feel. Yeah, a book is an it. A human being and a human touch. Not sexual touch, no. I became a diplomat in sexology. That's another topic. But human touch, we all have skin hunger. So I hope you go and hug yourself, because self-love is self-care. It's not narcissistic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking of the book being in it, though, you were saved in a way by reading Viktor Frankl's book.
That's right.
And that ultimately became your writing.
He became my mentor, my colleague, because I didn't have the verbal capacity. I didn't want people to feel sorry for me until I read Man's Search for Meaning, and he gave me the words. And that's when I began to speak, and then I did the keynote address for his 90th birthday. You know, he was 75 when he took flying lessons, and pretty amazing. And so I am very grateful. And I think my book is a female voice of Viktor Frankl. Yeah. I'm not Viktor Frankl, I'm Edie. And so I'm giving the female voice, but he has been the one who somehow gave me the words that I could now finally get up and tell people where I was. But most of all, what I discovered and how Auschwitz was an opportunity for me be who I am today. Mm-hmm. And for you to interview me and keep writing, because I don't think I'm going to be able to do anything other than letting people know that it ain't over. It ain't over. So go home. And if you have someone in a family who's a survivor and doesn't want to talk, ask your grandchildren to go and say, you know, I need to make an A in history. Would you please help me out? And they'll talk.
Mm-hmm. I think
it's a way to do it.
This book, your voice will live on through this book. I'm wondering if you know about the holograms that are now being created of survivors. Have you heard about this?
Tell me. You're so actively, beautifully.
Well, there's doing that. At the Skokie Museum outside of Illinois, they now have these prototypes of holograms that have been created by the Shoah Foundation, where they spend I don't know how many hours filming survivors, telling their stories, so that these holograms can be interactive for students, young people. So
they are the future. I tell them, you are the ambassadors for peace, and I owe it to them. So I go from school to school to school to school, because they say the Holocaust didn't exist, and I say, you know, you got to read Plato, and says that you have to be thinking of a lie, and it's got to be a big one, and then you repeat it. So our biggest enemy is ignorance. Question authority. Don't blindly adhere to authority, as I had to do.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, what do you say then to the people who won't be able to hear someone like you speak?
I never defend myself. And the Holocaust didn't guess, yes it did, like, no, I don't do that. I said, you know what? I don't know, where is your nearest German consulate? If you don't have one, go to Washington, and they're going to tell you. Mm-hmm. See? I don't get into, see, any behavior you pay attention to, you reinforce that. I don't reward that. No, I don't reward that. You see?
You said
go to Washington, because the largest Jewish population today lives in Germany. And they did fess up. And I was in Berlin, and they write the name of the people who lived in this house. And it's in the middle of Berlin. No, they're not forgetting. No, they're not forgetting. And I think I really would like to give credit where credit is due. Because the biggest... because defense mechanism is denial.
So it's Germany denied. Is serving as a model, I often say, to the rest of the world about how to take responsibility for your most heinous history. And your book, you said, has it been translated into German? It's already out in Germany?
Yes, it's my book is in German, and it's being published in German. And I tell you, there is justice in the world.
I see the smile on her face. Yeah.
I think so. I think so. And for you and I, the child of a survivor, for me to be here, I wish we had more time to talk about how the children of survivors grow up very fast. And if I may ask you, you know, I told you I'd like to ask two questions. One is, when did your childhood end? And many of the children had to take care of alcoholic parents and so on. And the second question, would you like to be married to you?
She told me to ask her those questions because she always asks them.
So, I like that.
So what's your answer? So would you like to be married to you?
Married to me? Well, I...
You seem pretty fantastic to me.
Well, what it is, you know, that we marry people we don't know. My definition of love is the ability to let go. Because falling in love is a chemical high that lonely people get from chocolate. I'm not knocking it, but it's temporary. Mm-hmm. I think if you can marry your best friend, your soulmate, the more you have in common, the better. Because if you marry someone like Romeo and Juliet, they don't know each other. So people ask me, did you love your husband? I said, love. I met him in a TB hospital. He wrote me letters, he went home, and he brought me Hungarian salami. That did it. And Swiss cheese, that did it. I didn't know where he came from. So I married this man who came from a wealthiest family from Czechoslovakia, inherited his grandfather's business, great-grandfather. And the communists came, they confiscated the business, and they threw him in jail. I'm a survivor, I don't say why me. Immediately, I said, what now? I put this in my little girl's diaper. I took my big diamond ring, and I went to the jail. And I smuggled my husband out, and we came to America penniless. That's how. You see, the survivor that, you know, what now, what I can do, and, you know, I don't have time to feel sorry for myself. But I never forget what happened. But I don't live there. It's my cherished wound, yes.
When did your childhood end?
My childhood ended when my mother stayed home on weekends and my father went out with his cronies to play billiards. And I began to look at my mom as she is talking to her mother who died when she was 9 years old. She slept with her mother, she died, and she was buried right away, and my mother was convinced that they buried her alive. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at mom, taking care of her mom, talking about PTSD. I wanted my mother to give me the unconditional love, and she was still holding on, and I was there babysitting, taking care of my mom as she was talking to me about Gone with the Wind, and that's how I think I became my mother's caretaker. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell her now that she introduced me to culture, to the books, to the theater, And so I'm very, very, very sorry she's not with me now. And that's why I always ask people, be a good mom to you. Ask questions before you do anything. Is this really good for me? And I also ask you to ask yourself, before you say anything, is it kind? And if it's not kind, don't say it. So get rid of yes but and say yes and. Because sometimes we say, I hear that all the time, you know, Edie, I finally cleaned my closet after 30 years, but I didn't do my kitchen, but I didn't do that, you see? Mm-hmm. And I say, you know, let's celebrate what is and get rid of the yes but. Mm. Yes and I'm here, I'm alive, and I do everything in my power, hopefully, to be a good role model. So when you are 90, you're going to silly, you know, think about me as someone who's giving you an opportunity today to come here that may be a most important time in your life that you know you have a choice. Because the more choices you have, the less you feel like a victim.
The last word of your book is the word free.
Free. I'm very biased on freedom. And I know that in Berkeley, people like to ask questions. And I don't know if there is time
I think we're almost out of time. What I would actually love to ask you, you can say no, but on behalf of the Berkeley audience, we've been told that you end your talks with a ballet kick.
Oh, my God.
Can you do it?
Oh, I don't know.
Should I hold your hand?
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.